You've landed inside Launch Street, the Business Innovation Podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate, differentiate, and get further faster. Since you're here, we know you're the type of person that recognizes the importance of unlocking your innovation advantage so you can compete and win. And now, your host, the person that has worked with leading companies like Disney, Procter & Gamble, Arrow Electronics, the U.S. Army Research Labs, and Red Robin on upping their innovation advantage, Tamara Gontor.
What's up? It is a wonderful day on Launch Street, isn't it? Oh my gosh, that sounded so cheesy. Okay, but there's a reason I'm excited, because today I officially announce our new sponsor, Brility Digital. Now, in full disclosure, Launch Street also works with Brility, but that's also how I know they do incredible work. So when we came together for them to sponsor the podcast, I was so excited. All right, here goes. This episode of Inside Launch Street is brought to you by Brility Digital, who tackles incredibly tough business challenges from a strategic growth perspective in order to implement the most effective digital resources in order to meet your objectives. Highly recommend that you go check them out. In fact, they have an incredible offer they're willing to give Launch Streeters, all of us, for free. So check it out in the show notes. Because I didn't want to just bring you a sponsor. I wanted to bring you insights. So I also do a short interview partway through the show with founder Derek Kuhn. He is mad genius. And check out the show notes, like I said, because we have a link to their digital presence assessment for your business or brand. It usually costs thousands, but they made it free to Launch Streeters that qualify. Oh my gosh, you're going to love the interview too. All right, now to the podcast interview itself. Okay, so this morning, I listed out all the things I needed to get done. And now, needed is in air quotes, because I think I'm guilty of confusing need to get done with busy work that makes me feel productive. The list is so long. And it got me thinking about how not just to use my time better, but how to work smarter so that I could not only get the right things done, but also have more space to be innovative. And then I talked to Ari Mizell, and he shared with me his three decisions process of delete, deal, defer. Totally changed how I think about my work. As did his create, capture, sort system for ideation. So I think my talk with Ari will get you thinking about how you approach your work, maybe even get you out of the work harder loop. Actually, I think it's more of a trap, and into the work smarter habit. Now, Ari is a self-proclaimed overwhelmologist and the founder of Less Doing. His recent book, The Replaceable Founder, helps innovators like you and me scale what we do with tools to communicate effectively, manage projects, and perfect processes. Sounds good, right? Okay, it's game time. Ari, thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, thank you for having me, Tamara.
So tell me, what's your first memory of being innovative?
So I think it's when I was 7 and I was a magician and I was doing birthday parties for 3-year-olds. That was my first innovation, I think.
Oh my God, did they love it? Did they ask you back? Were you actually requested?
Yes, I was. And one time the two of the parents paid me separately without realizing that the other one had paid me, and I didn't really know what to do, so I took the money.
That's on them, man. So I have to ask you, because your first business was at 12-year-old, right? What was that business?
Yeah.
I love that story.
So when I was 12, I started a website design company, and basically I had just been playing around with HTML and stuff at the time, which, you know, seemed like a natural thing for a 12-year-old in the 90s to do. And because my father is an art dealer, I was exposed to a lot of artists and art galleries, and I just found a niche for myself building websites for people in that business.
And did you I have to ask, was this, did you just work for your dad and one friend, or did this actually turn into something?
No. I did a website for my dad, but then somebody came in and asked about his website and he offered to pay me, and then I worked for him. And then, so we did actually several hundred websites. I ended up hiring a couple people that were peers of mine at school, and yeah,
awesome.
It turned into a real business.
It's like instead of the AV club, right? You're like the website HTML club.
Right.
I love it. So let's leap forward, because one of the things I loved when I was kind of reading about you was that you're a self-described, let me see if I can say this right, overwhelmologist. Is
yes.
that right? So
yeah.
One of the things that you are super passionate about and really focus on is doing less. Talk about all of that. Like, what does that mean?
Yeah, so the very short story is that when I was 23, I got sick with a chronic illness that knocked me down from basically, I was doing like 18-hour days of work to a situation where I could I was struggling to get a work an hour of work done in a given day, and presented with that very real limitation. You know, if you ask somebody who works a 9-to-5 job, you say, what would you do if you could only work till 4? It's pretty easy for them to say, like, oh, I'd skip lunch, or, you know, maybe I'd take one less meeting. But you ask somebody, what would you do if you could only work an hour in a day? It requires a completely different way of thinking that, in my view, at the time didn't exist. So I was dealing with an extreme constraint. I still had things that needed to get done and family. There's things that we all have to get done. And so if the question at that point is not what wouldn't you do, but how would you get these things done that have to get done if you can't do them? I ended up creating a brand new system of productivity, which I called less doing, as in less doing, more living. And the goal was to teach people how to optimize, automate, and outsource everything in their lives in order to be more effective.
So let's dig in a little bit to that. And maybe it kind of goes back to your first experience. And you know, I have to say, it's so fascinating. I have a couple of friends who have had major health issues almost out of nowhere, but knock them off their feet in their 40s. And their revelation about how busy but not productive they were, or what they could get done in shorter amounts of time, has really changed how they work for the better. And their businesses are thriving. So it's not that they're doing less, making less. It's actually that they're doing less, making more, which is fantastic. But I want to go kind of dig into that for a second. So you know, whether it's an hour, 4 hours, whatever, right? You've got an extreme constraint. How do you create criteria for what gets in and what doesn't? And then that criteria for what gets, I guess, automated or outsourced and what doesn't?
So the short answer, again, is like anything that's not in your genius or your zone of genius, basically, or things that give you joy or things where you're going to have the most impact, those are the things you shouldn't be doing. Now, I know that sounds extremely idealistic, but that's the goal. And what we teach now is something I call the replaceable founder, where I want to make people as replaceable as possible so that they can focus on what they do best, have the flexibility to work where and when they want, and have the freedom ultimately to leave if that's what they chose to do. So the truth is very, very few things make it past that filter at this point. I work in a situation now where I take my kids to school in the morning. I work while they're at school. I pick them up and I'm with my kids and I'm with my wife. And I'm still able to work privately with 50 clients around the world, run workshops, travel when needed, and make that all work. And there's no such thing as a work-life balance. It's a work-life integration, because you don't magically become some other person when you're doing these other activities, right? So the filter there is that you have to be able to say no to commit. I never want people to say no to opportunities, but you definitely have to be able to say no to commitments. And we have a really hard time doing that.
Well, and I think sometimes we mistake commitments for opportunities. You know, I just got an email from a girlfriend of mine who was asking, should I take this opportunity? And as I was reading through it, I thought to myself, this isn't an opportunity. This is a time suck. But because it was an international thing, she saw it as an opportunity. I think we mistake the two.
Oh, all the time. And part of the problem with the overwhelm is that people don't know what's causing the overwhelm. And I know that sounds really circular, but it's also really crucial because, you know, human beings can take a lot of crap, right? And we just put our heads down and we keep digging. And it takes more effort sometimes to look up and make sure you're actually heading in the right direction. So if we have this sort of systematic mindset, this habit of looking for the opportunities to do that, then it becomes a lot easier. And we also have to limit the number of decisions that we make in a given situation. And realize, so we teach something called the three decisions. And in pretty much every situation you're faced, from somebody asking you to travel somewhere to an email in your inbox, there are basically three decisions that you should – one of three decisions that you can choose from that, not 40 that a lot of people end up going through.
So can we go through those three? Because I'd love to know what they are.
Yeah. We always teach this through email because it's just the easiest way to do it. But this applies – to all decisions. So the three D's are delete it, deal with it, or defer it. So delete it in real life would be decline, right? Deny, say no. Deal with it is, if you can deal with it right now, then you need to deal with it right now, because this concept that we have in our heads that it'll only take a minute and somehow this minute is going to magically appear later on, you know, at 6 o'clock when the kids need to be fed and like you just got home. And we always think that there's this magical minute that shows up there. We're going to do it then. It's not the case. Do it now. if you can do it now. Because more importantly than that, than you know, the fact that you might not get to it later, if you're not doing something now that you could do now that somebody else might be waiting on, you are creating
a bottleneck.
Really bad bottleneck. Absolutely. Yeah.
And then so, defer it is the other one, right?
Yeah. And well, but so with dealing with it could include delegating it, which if you delegate properly, then you are done in that moment because you've given it to somebody who has the resources they need. They're empowered to get it done. And there's nothing else for you to do until they come back to you, if they come back to you. That third D is defer it. Yes. Which is a really hard one for a lot of people. There are better times and places for you to do different things in your life. And recognizing that just because something is priority for the day doesn't mean that you can effectively do it right now. So a good example of that would be creative work. And it's different for every person, but I just can't do creative work. And creative work for me is generally like making videos, and I don't get to do as much writing anymore. I have a writer on my team now. But creative work for me generally has to happen after 8 o'clock at night.
Huh. Is that when you feel like you're most in the zone, or is that just a matter of like the house is quiet, kids are asleep?
It's probably a confluence of all those things. We tend to be more creative when we're tired because we're less likely to like shoot down our own.
Right. To filter ourselves. Yeah.
I had something about it. I'm just more comfortable making videos and stuff at that time. So if somebody on my team tells me at 10 in the morning, like, we really need this video today, for me to, it's like, great. Okay. No problem. I'm going to do it at 8 o'clock at night. But whereas most people will be like, all right, I'm going to start working on it right now. And they're going to try to slog through it in a time that's really not optimal for them to do it. And if they're able to complete it at all, the result is going to be subpar. So it's really freeing to be able to say, yeah, I can't do this right now. And it doesn't matter that it's a priority. Like, it will get done the right way at this time. And that's not procrastination. That's really actively taking control of your time.
So I have two questions rattling around in my brain. But the first one is, I mean, I love this three decisions, delete, deal, defer. It really does make it easy. And I'm assuming with defer, it is deferred to a scheduled or appropriate time, not push off.
Exactly. Yeah. Never want to defer till tomorrow. Right.
Right. Right.
All about it.
Right. Like an actual, like, I'm going to get to this on Friday at X time. And, you know, it's interesting. I started doing this, this sticky notes on my wall where I put everything I have to do and I put it on certain days. And it also, I find, gives me a lot of mental freedom when I know I'm not doing it right now, but it's on my list for Friday. So I'm definitely doing it Friday. I don't know. If I don't do that, then that thing, even if it's just responding to an email for coffee, rattles around in my brain all night if I don't know it's going to get done. And then that just sucks up, I think, mental space that could be applied to other stuff.
Exactly. And you're 100% right. And that's the mindset shift that needs to take place, is that you're really doing yourself a huge disservice by not dealing with these things in the right time and place.
So here's my first question then. So, you know, for me, I'm top of my food chain because I'm president of the company. So it's very easy for me to delegate and to defer, probably less to deal, to be honest, because that's one where I'm like, I got to stop what I'm doing and deal with this. But, you know, we have a lot of listeners who are inside companies. So they've got jobs, they've got bosses. How do you manage being the system mindset, which I love, by the way, I think all of us can apply it, whether we're intrapreneurs or entrepreneurs. But how do you think of that if you are, you know, in the middle of the food chain, so to speak?
Yeah, you just have a different set of constraints to work with.
Yeah.
I mean, and the thing is yes, you may not have complete autonomy over your time and when you can have meetings or not have meetings, but we can do the best possible. So if you know, for example, what your peak time is, and peak time is a biological time that's different for everybody, but it's a 90-minute period of the day when you're really much more effective than any other time of the day. If you know what that is, then you can try to not have a team meeting during that time. If possible, right? That would be a huge win. If you can't do it, doesn't mean you can't be productive. You have to look for other ways to do things. Even simple things like the Pomodoro technique, where you're working in sprints and then breaking it up with these 5-minute breaks. There's always a way to do things. It just depends on what those constraints are. I'm a really big believer that constraints are the real like life force of innovation.
Say, tell me more about that.
So, were you ever a fan of MacGyver?
Uh huh. Oh my gosh, please.
Okay. So nobody.
I'm a product
ever said,
of the 80s. Of course I am.
Right. Okay. Well, me too. It's 1982.
Yeah.
So nobody ever said to MacGyver, "Hey, man, there's a Home Depot across the street. Go get anything you need, and go blow up that building, right? It was like, here's a paperclip and some duct tape.
Right. Blow up that building. It was always a paperclip.
It was always a paperclip, sometimes Bisquick. And so I really just always believe that, like, if you're given less, like, you're going to create more innovations from that, not more, which is very hard for a lot of entrepreneurs, particularly, to swallow, right? Because entrepreneurs love their freedom and it's all about freedom. But freedom's really bad for our brains when we're actually trying to come up with solutions.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I talk a lot about rearranging the box you have versus thinking outside the box, because I actually think within those constraints, you are forced to be more innovative. And frankly, when you go to pure freedom and then try to bring it back, those constraints that are your reality bump up against your crazy out of the box, all freedom ideas, and they don't tend to get work. So, and then they get shelved. So I actually think, to your point, in a lot of ways, that constraint is one of the most helpful things you can do. And I haven't met anyone, entrepreneur or intrapreneur, who has said to me, I have all the resources I want and need. In fact, I have too much. I have too many. Do you want some of mine? Like, I've never heard that from someone.
Yeah, right. And also, to your point, right, you can think outside the box, but there still needs to be a box.
Right. Somewhere there's a box.
Yeah.
All right. I am here with Derek, who is the president of Brility. So, Derek, your company Brility is amazing at helping your clients think and act differently and leverage an experimental mindset to stand out. So how does having an experimental mindset help you do that?
Well, thanks, Tamara. I would say the experimental mindset is essential for long-term success and predictable success. We are all about building a system that is reliable for growth. And to do that, you have to challenge assumptions. The experimental mindset allows us to put our best foot forward, adapt and iterate, and really learn what is causal to work so that we have predictable success. We really are in a dynamic environment right now. Technology is changing, business is changing, and assumptions need to be challenged. So in order to do that, we need to craft careful experiments where we can learn, adapt, and grow.
What's the downside of not experimenting?
The assumptions. I mean, you see Blockbuster gets wiped out by Netflix. There is a graveyard of companies out there who thought they had it figured out, and they marched towards a certain doom because others were out there experimenting and figuring out what works and what doesn't and adapting to the changing marketplace. Amazon runs 10,000 concurrent experiments at once. There's a reason they dominate e-commerce. Google does the same thing. Facebook does the same thing.
Wow. So can you share with me one example of how Brility did that for one of your clients?
We have a GIS client, which is a type of software that does mapping and locations. They are a small startup, but very, very well funded. And they're going up against a massive incumbent. And there isn't a current name or explanation for their offering. It's not commonly searched for or known. And what we had to do was run dozens of experiments to see what language at a high level resonated with their audience, which were anywhere from engineers to salespeople to VPs. And through that, we really found what surprised us most was not outcome and benefit-based promises, but actual screenshots of the technology, which seemed to immediately and intuitively have the users grasp how it was utilized. And there's a shift in the marketplace that people are sick of platitudes and promises. They want to see a little bit of how things are done. Those experiments were very revealing, and we're doubling down on them for the client now, and it's very successful.
All right, launch readers, what we need to figure out, I know I'm going to go do right now, is figure out where I'm experimenting and where I'm assuming. Derek, thank you so much for coming by.
Thank you.
I'd love to hear you talk about linking kind of having more space and doing less with your ability to innovate. And I think you hinted a little bit at it with, you know, having that time blocked out for you. But talk more about that, how those two really come together.
Well, so like for me, for example, right, like I said, I basically work while my kids are at school. So that is a constraint for me. And what that means is that sometimes when I have clients that are on the West Coast and they want to have a call with me in the afternoon, like the answer has to be no. And I know for a fact that I've lost business over that. And I'm okay with that because there's sort of an end result that plays out that I want. And it makes it really easy for me to make those decisions. So part of the constraint aspect too is that, again, it makes it easier for you to make a decision because you have those sort of rules set up front. The big thing that a lot of people don't do is they get very reactive, right? And I think we know that, right?
Yeah, so it's putting out fires all day.
Exactly. So instead of putting out fires, we really want people to be building a fireproof building. And there's a lot more opportunity to do that than we realize. And if you think about these things up front, it becomes a lot easier to deal with them when they actually come up.
Do you think that's a matter of because you have the time and the freedom or because you're not just constantly – I mean, I find that when I'm harried all day, I'm not innovative because I'm stressed, frankly. You know, and I'm just not in the right mindset. Is it a matter of, you know, kind of being able to tap that part of your brain? Is it a matter of just having more space?
So, so I have an interesting, I think I have a sort of different approach to that. I would argue that, you know, even if you're stressed, right, that I still would say that you're probably getting some really good ideas throughout the day.
Yeah, well, it kind of goes back to your point about constraints, actually. Once I said it out loud, I was like, actually, that probably helps.
Yeah, well, but what you really need and what a lot of us don't have in place is a proper system for capturing your ideas. And a system is a key one. So if you have like a notebook that you're carrying around that you're writing notes in, but I'm sure a lot of people listening have that, that's not a system. It's good that you have that, but that's not a system. There needs to be a recognition that there's a time and place for you to come up with your ideas. There's a different time and place for you to sort those ideas and a very different time and place for you to actually work on those ideas. But if you have a system in place to capture those ideas throughout the day, it becomes a lot less stressful because you're not worried about – you're not getting distracted when you have a good idea because you can capture it and kind of move on with your life. And you're not worrying that you're losing out on those good ideas. So if anything, I think that the stress in some cases, the chaos breeds some of our best ideas. But what's actually stressful is that we can't stop and capture them.
That's interesting. Will you talk more about that? Because I think you're right. I mean, I think it's one thing to be like, aha, and another thing to kind of walk through the process. So can you kind of walk us through in a little more detail of, I don't know if I said it, if I wrote it down exactly right, the create, capture, sort. Did I get it right?
Yeah. So that you're ideating in one situation, right? Which is going to happen really all day long if you have a poll. So then there's what some entrepreneurs end up doing, what a lot of entrepreneurs end up doing, right, is they get an idea. Or even worse in some cases, like they block out their creative time and then they get an idea in that like 3-hour block that they've created for themselves magically. And then they go work on that one idea for like 3 hours and then they really don't get anywhere. And that's essentially shiny object syndrome.
Yeah.
So you really have to recognize that like there's a totally different mindset that goes into the person that's coming up with ideas versus the person that can actually work on those ideas. Like we wear different hats essentially in those different modes. So one thing is that I never want people to be more than 20 seconds away from capturing an idea, no matter where they are, no matter what they're doing. So that can take the form of screenshots on your phone, sending a voice message using WhatsApp, or calling a phone number and leaving a voicemail, or capturing a website that you look at by email. All of these things should be at your disposal. You literally want, like, in every corner of your life. I mean, I have 3 Amazon Echo devices in our house for that very reason. And at any time, I can say, you know, Alexa, remind me about this. And that specifically will add it to a Trello board. So all of those different things come to me as a Trello, in a Trello board. You know Trello, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So at night, at 8 o'clock at night, generally, it's part of my like night routine. I don't really have a morning routine. I have a night routine. And that involves going through all of the ideas that have been captured throughout the day, which are now Trello cards. And now I can say at that point, I'm not going to work on the ideas, but I'm going to sort them. So I can say, all right, this is the thing I want to talk to my wife about. So, you know, I'll put that aside for, you know, 20 minutes or an hour or something when I'm actually going to sit and talk to my wife. This is something that I want Courtney on my team to do, so I'm going to move it over to this Trello board and assign it to her. This is something I want to give to a VA to take care of, so I'll assign it to the virtual assistant. And that sorting process is so pleasurable because it's you're just pulling the levers and things are getting done. And one of those things may be like a big project that I want to work on, and so that's going to go to a certain time and place when I know I can actually do that.
So there's one thing I really want to call out, Ari, that I think you're saying that's super important that we miss often. And I think that is that there's a time to innovate and a time to analyze, but they're not the same time. And
they are not the same time.
Yeah. And I think we, you know, I actually have a colleague who's deep in the kind of neuroscience and how it all works in the brain. And we were talking about the fact that your brain can't actually do both at the same time. So oftentimes when we think we're innovating, we're actually analyzing because we're judging too soon.
Yeah.
So capture it all without any judgment, regardless of how ridiculous it may seem in the moment, and then deal with the analyzing and the sorting later, which is kind of what I hear you talk about in the system as well.
Yeah, and you know, you have to keep in mind that from an evolutionary standpoint, like if it's not about finding food, shelter, or the opportunity to procreate, like our brains are really not interested in it, and we'll shoot down most ideas that don't have to do with one of those
yeah,
things.
Yeah, well, our lizard brain doesn't want to be uncomfortable, so it's like, we'll just move on from that one.
Yeah, exactly.
What do you think stops individuals from innovating? I want to start with the creating part of this. What do you think stops them from being prolific there? Because to your point earlier, I think you said it in one of the stories that you're doing it all day long, really.
Yeah, I mean, it's. I think in some cases it's the curse of knowledge, which is basically like it's very hard to take a beginner's mindset on things. And assuming like content is a really good example. I've worked with so many people who just don't think that anything that they have to say is interesting. And like they know that they're good at what they do, but they don't think that what they have to say would be interesting to other people. And it's like you don't understand that most people don't know the things that you know. And it doesn't matter what you do. I mean, the fact that there are people making millions and millions of dollars on YouTube playing with toys. Right. Everybody's got to play with toys.
What's that, like 12-year-old kid? And he's not even 12. I think he's 10. He's like making millions doing that.
Yeah, Ryan's great. He's
great. Right. That's right.
Right. But yeah. My daughter likes Ryan. So but that's the point is like, do you know how many people will be like, well, who would care? No one wants to watch me play with toys. But somebody did, you know.
Right.
So everything that we do is unique in one way or another, and we need to be able to share that. We just can't see outside of ourselves often. So that's part of this idea too, with having a separation between the ideation and the sorting and the working on, is that you literally get to have like your own sounding board for things, right? Because you're going to have a different view on things. It can marinate a little bit. And you might decide 12 hours later that, yeah, that was a really stupid idea. I'm going to throw it out. But that's great, because that stupid idea then wasn't rattling around in your brain taking up space.
Well, and I will tell you that sometimes I write stuff down that I think is ridiculous in the moment, and then when I go back to it, it's not I'll give you an example. It's ridiculous, but because, you know, I'm in Denver. It snows. And there's nothing worse than if you parked on the street having to kind of get yourself out, or when you're starting to slip a little bit. And I thought, because I'd just been at hot yoga, and I thought, wouldn't it be great to have a hot yoga mat or like a heated mat that you could put under your tire? That way you just need to get out of the curb, you know, like you just need a moment. And I wrote it down. I'm not in the product business. I'm not, you know, that type of entrepreneur, but I wrote it down. I put it in my notes. And then a week later, when I went back and looked, I looked at the idea, and that idea I didn't do anything with, but it made me think of something else for my business of like, oh, how do I get people to over that first hurdle where they're slipping a little bit and they kind of lose steam and don't go forward. So sometimes I think those crazy ideas, if you don't analyze them too soon, become the impetus for something else later.
Yeah, well, that's right. You don't have a crystal ball, right? You can't possibly know if your ideas are good or bad. And you definitely can't know if those ideas are going to be relevant ever.
Well, you don't know, right? So how do you, Ari, how do you decide which ones are worth keeping around and which ones are just shelf for later?
So most of them are shelf. I mean, honestly, you know, at some point you have to decide like what it is that you actually like doing and what, you know, really what you want to do. Right. And so at some point the question really just becomes like, yeah, this might be an amazing idea, but does it really serve what I'm trying to do?
Right. That's kind of the shiny ball thing of it. Is it an opportunity or a commitment?
Yeah. Right. And everything is an opportunity to learn, right? And so you can maybe kick it down the road a little bit. But it's those commitments that I think people fall into accidentally and then they're stuck.
So what are the red flags for – if I were to look at my life, or any one of us Launch Streeters, you know, listening, if we were to kind of look for those red flags to say, all right, we're doing too much, and not just meaning I've got a lot of responsibilities, but I'm in overwhelm, I'm doing too much, I'm stretched too thin, and I need to back up and put some boundaries on it, which, by the way, for – Launch Streeters, I would say that one of the lessons I've learned in my 25 plus years being in business, and Ari, I'd love to hear you speak to this, is for those of us who put boundaries on our work, it's a little bit scary at first, but people really do abide by them. You have to decide how people are going to treat you. So I don't know. I feel like especially when you work with and for other people, you get a little nervous of like, I can't say I'd really rather not have meetings from 8 to 9 because that's my creative time. But if you actually set that boundary, people are actually pretty willing to go along with it.
Yeah. Well, and especially if you're the boss, right, you can make that decision pretty easily as long as you stick to it. The problem is a lot of people don't end up sticking to it.
That's true.
And what that really does is it just undermines your people's, your team's ability to be empowered, which is not leadership. That's management. And we want more leadership.
That's a great point. So going back to the question I was trying to ask before I totally derailed myself, which was, what are those red flags to say, all right, I need to stop and reassess and take a look? Because I have to imagine that it's very easy for all of us to go from a good place of doing less and really being in our you know, ability to perform at our peak to suddenly being in overwhelm without even realizing it. So what red flags can we look for to keep us from getting there and to take that deep breath?
First of all, keep in mind that less doing is not about doing less. It's about doing less of the things that don't really like bring you joy and make you better.
And move you forward, yeah.
So I'm very busy, right, by like an outward standard. I get a lot of stuff done. And I'm always filling up those holes with more stuff because I love it. So the red flags are, I mean, this is a simple one, I think, is that look at your day, not in terms of what you're doing in the day or what you're getting done or how you're dividing it up or any of that stuff. Try to divide up your day in terms of who the time is for. And look at that. So for me, 6 to 9 in the morning is for my kids. 9 to 3 is for my team and my clients. 3 to 8 is for my kids. 8 to 10 is for my wife. And sometimes, usually, 10 to 11 is for me. Now, if you're religious, 15 minutes in the morning might be for God, right? You should, and think about who that time is for. And if you look at that and there's a very obvious imbalance of time, or there's no time for you or things like that, then something's out of whack.
Do you think meetings and number of emails are an indicator?
Number of emails definitely are. Meetings are not necessarily, but generally speaking, we can do way, way more things asynchronously that don't require a live meeting. And number of emails, I think, I have a, you don't want to get me started on this.
I actually wanted to ask you about your thing. I was reading it and your whole thing with emails. So talk a little bit about that, because I actually – email is such a challenge, you know, and I think that we use it too frequently and incorrectly, but I would love to hear your take on email.
Yeah, so if you can't manage your email, then there's a lot of other things that you're not managing properly, because the email problem is not an email problem, it's a decision-making problem. And the email is just an example where we can make way more decisions than in any other place that we sort of naturally have. Now we have a whole system that we teach around Inbox Zero, and the three decisions really goes into it. But having somebody else manage your email for you is a terrible, terrible move. That's just, I mean, it actually makes me like almost angry when people talk about that, because it's just such a silly way of approaching it. You don't if that's the case, and email is so overwhelming for you and you don't like email, don't have email. Yeah, like nobody forced you to have email, and there are billionaires in the world who have never had an email address.
Right.
So it's the idea that it's like, oh my God, email. So like, I don't even look at it anymore. There's so many. It's like, that's so foolish. That's as bad as a leader of a company saying like, you know, you guys work this out. I'm just going to step out of this one.
So how do you manage it better then? Because I do think in business today, it is a challenge for people.
Part of the problem is that people use email for too many things. Email should not be used for internal communication ever under any circumstances in any company. And a lot of them do that. So email is an external communication tool. It is a transactional communication tool. It should never be used for discussions or brainstorming. For that, you need a separate tool like Slack or something else.
Yeah, we use Basecamp, which we love.
So that, and that's fine.
Yeah.
So, and that has a purpose, right? So, if you're going to have something like for customer support issues or sales issues, you should be using something like Intercom or Zendesk or things like that. So a lot of this stuff shouldn't be getting through email in the first place.
So how do you train people to not use email?
You just show them that there's another way and set up a system to let them do that. I mean, a lot of them just, so many companies use email internally. And then if you show them Slack and now this is where you're going to communicate about this stuff from now on, you're not allowed to email each other. It's like an overnight change typically.
Yeah, I will tell you, when we moved to Basecamp, it was life-changing for us. Like really, I know it sounds kind of dramatic, but suddenly, first of all, suddenly my emails were from clients and, you know, external partners that I needed to communicate with. And I could find those emails because I wasn't getting 200 emails a day. And the chain of emails, like things get lost in translation. And it was just a nightmare. And now all the communication is with the project. So there's no trying to remember, I could have sworn you said something about this project. It's in the project box. So you're right. I think, I don't know, email is one of those things. I also think people use it as a filing cabinet. So they leave everything in the email thinking, I'll come back to this one day. But honestly, that just like kills me.
Yeah. And that's, they're using it for the wrong purpose.
Yeah. So, all right. So where can, before I ask you the last question, where can people go to learn and connect more with you?
So everything that we do is at lessdoing.com. They can find out about my podcast, my books, our coaching programs. We do these really great live events, these one-day workshops called the Replaceable Founder Intensive. Everything is at lessdoing.com. But if they go to less.do, that's D-O, less.do/foundations, there's this really, I think, really helpful quick mini video course that we created that they can get for free.
Awesome. And we'll put the link in the show notes. Last question for you is, what's that one last, that one advice you have for people trying to make room and, as you said, not just do less, but do the right things?
So really make it part of your mindset to look at how you're doing the things you're doing and stop just doing them. And that sounds simple, but you know, you all don't do it.
So, what?
Stop and look at the actual processes involved in what you're doing. And think about why, and you might be surprised.
I love it. Well, Ari, that was fantastic. I just put a little sticky note up on my screen that says delete, deal, defer.
Yeah.
So that I can remember every time. That was fantastic. Thank you. All right. Before you go, did you put a sticky note up that says delete, deal, delegate? I did. It's sitting on my desk, and it's totally helped me. So for those of you that know your innovator archetypes, you probably caught on that Ari is an instinctual futuristic. It's evident in his desire to systematize things. He knows he's going to have to do it again, so he creates these systems to scale his work. It's brilliant. And the instinctual side of him is able to see the patterns and the trends, how things connect. It was so cool. So if how Ari thought about things resonates with you, you may also be an instinctual futuristic as well. Go to our website, find out for yourself. Tamara, out.
Thanks for hanging with us on Inside Launch Street. If you know someone that is truly ready to unlock their innovation advantage, have them join you on Launch Street. Discover your innovation advantage. Build a team of high-performing innovators and ignite ideas and solutions that create massive impact. G-O-T-O, launchstreet.com. Remember, innovators, if you don't take the leap, somebody else will.